Welcome to Object Matters, the podcast of the Chow Chak Wing Museum at the University of Sydney. My name's Craig Barker and I'm the Head of Public Engagement for the museum. In this episode, my guest is Brent Carahona. The aim of this podcast, of course, is to reflect upon the personal connection between a guest and a collection item from the Chow Chak Wing Museum. But today we've got a very, very special connection between our guest and an incredibly special item in the museum. And it'll give us a chance to explore the way museums might engage on a personal as well as a cultural perspective. Today, we're going to travel 200 years back in time to learn about a remarkable man and a remarkable culture. Firstly, welcome, Brent.
Yeah, thanks for the opportunity. It's great to be here.
Now, Brent, I'm wondering if you could tell our listeners a little bit about yourself.
Okay, about myself. Well, firstly, let me recite a Māori proverb that goes, Kaore te kumara e kōrero mō tōna ake reka. And that basically means the kumara or the sweet potato never talks about its sweetness. And that's in relation to modesty and humbleness and allowing others to talk about your achievements rather than yourself.
That's a really beautiful sentiment, Brent. In that case, I'm going to talk about you. You are, of course, an educator and a tireless promoter of Maori culture here in Sydney. Could you talk a little bit about your background, your family background?
Okay, so my background is a little bit different in that I was born and raised in Australia. I grew up in the Blue Mountains. Now, that was all except for a few years living in a Potiki in the Bay of Plenty in New Zealand as an infant. So I was relatively estranged from my Māori heritage and culture for much of my childhood and adolescent life. But after serving 10 years in the army, I started to research my whakapapa, which is family history. And I started to realize that my family had a lot of characters, a lot of people who were influential in the building of New Zealand or in the history of New Zealand. And that included Māori war chiefs. Māori chiefs like Moka te Kainga Mata, Rewa, Te Wharerahi, and of course the great Hongihika, of which we're going to speak today.
We will speak a lot about Hongihika in this podcast, but before we get to that, can I get you to talk a bit about your personal journey into discovering your own family history and cultural history and your immersion in broader Maori understanding of historical developments?
So over the last two decades, I've done some in-depth and comprehensive research into early New Zealand 19th century history, Māori history, especially in relation to the Ngāpuhi tribe, of which I affiliate. And that includes an interactive historical novel, which hopefully is finished next year. It includes a number of public events, of which one is coming up at the Chow Chak Wing Museum. A short film that we're currently producing. So we've been shooting nearly every weekend over the last, or say, 2 months. And the filming started prior to COVID. So we're filming in New Zealand. We're filming some of the scenes in England at places like Cambridge University and the Tower of London. But with COVID came an inevitable sort of cease to our filming. And we've just started to pick that up again now. So I think we've got one more weekend of filming and then we're off to Canberra for 2 weeks to start the editing process. I'm looking also at, I've written a couple of research papers. So one article was published in the Journal of Museum Ethnology in 2019, and that was basically about a Māori chief, Hongihika, his journey to England in 1820, and then a comparison of three carved wooden busts, of which we're going to speak today.
Fascinating, Brent, and I believe there's a few other projects you're working on as well.
Additionally, I've been working on an illustrated bilingual children's book, also focusing on Hongihika's 1820 journey to England, and working with a number of museums on a travelling exhibition in New Zealand, which I'll speak about a bit later. Of great note, though, is that over the past 2 weeks, I've been involved in a matter that was of extreme urgency and importance or significance for Ngāpuhi and Māori in general. And that was a musket that was up for auction at Webb's Auction House in New Zealand. And this musket was claimed to have been given to Hongihika by King George IV. Now, I'll speak about this a little bit later too, but I was really blessed and humbled to be instrumental in helping to have that item withdrawn from the auction and given my tribe an opportunity to further examine that for authenticity and then to make a decision on whether or not we wanted to try and secure that item. And so, that was a fantastic outcome, but I can speak about that a little bit later too. So that's the type of work that I've been able to do over the last 2 decades, and even living in Australia. So, you know, I think for much of my research life, up until probably the last 5 years, I didn't really think that my research and work would have been going anywhere, and I felt like I was sort of isolated in Australia, and the information that I had and that I know wasn't really being used to its full potential. But I can see now that, you know, it doesn't matter where you live, especially in this global world where we can connect through social media and things like that. And so, you know, you really can have an impact no matter where you live, as long as you have the information that's relevant or important at the time.
Now, you talk about that working relationship you've developed with museums. Could you talk a bit about the object from the Chow Chak Wing Museum collection that you've chosen to discuss on today's podcast?
So the artefact, or taonga, cultural treasure, that I'm going to speak about today is a carved wooden bust or head of the Māori chief Hongihika. So initially it was part of the Nicholson Museum collection, and then it was transferred over to the Maclay Museum, and now he has pride of place in the Chow Chak Wing Museum.
It's an extraordinary piece, and truly beautiful piece as well, Brent, but could you describe it for our listeners?
Okay, so we're looking at this taonga or artefact, and, you know, we'll take into consideration things like size, shape, texture, any decorations or features. But the first thing that I want to say is that, unlike a lot of Māori carvings, and especially of the time it was created, this actually looks like a realistic representation of a human head. Now, it's about 30 centimetres high, so it's not quite as big as a human head in size and proportion, but for all regards, it looks like a realistic human head. And when we talk about that, it could quite possibly be the very first Māori selfie, because Māori carvings are usually abstract, out of proportion, features are overemphasized, but this one really does represent a realistic human head. So as I said, it's about 30 centimeters high. It's quite small, so it's probably about half the size of a normal, if there is anything, you know, such as a normal human head. But the texture, it is quite smooth on the back. However, as you can imagine, the face is heavily etched. It's heavily etched with something known as a tāmoko, so a traditional Māori facial tattoo. And so this tāmoko is quite intricate. So there's a lot of detail in there. It's quite intricate. You know, and when you look at that and you look at pictures of Hongi, paintings of Hongi that were commissioned and done in England in the 1820s, it really does look like a realistic representation of the man himself. The decorations, well, obviously the tāmoko is the decoration. That's the main sort of focus of the bust. But he does have ears, so he does have protruding ears on this bust, and he also has a top knot or a bun of hair tied up at the rear of his head, top rear of his head. Now, that's different to the other two that I've seen. So for so long, we thought that this particular bust was the only one in existence. Okay, so we're looking at this taonga or artefact, and, you know, we'll take into consideration things like size, shape, texture, any decorations or features. But the first thing that I want to say is that, unlike a lot of Māori carvings, and especially of the time it was created, this actually looks like a realistic representation of a human head. Now, it's about 30 centimetres high, so it's not quite as big as a human head in size and proportion, but for all regards, it looks like a realistic human head. And when we talk about that, it could quite possibly be the very first Māori selfie, because Māori carvings are usually abstract, out of proportion, features are overemphasized, but this one really does represent a realistic human head. So as I said, it's about 30 centimeters high. It's quite small, so it's probably about half the size of a normal, if there is anything, you know, such as a normal human head. But the texture, It is quite smooth on the back. However, as you can imagine, the face is heavily etched. It's heavily etched with something known as a tāmoko, so a traditional Māori facial tattoo. And so This time walkway is quite intricate. So there's a lot of detail in there. It's quite intricate, you know. And when you look at that, and you look at pictures of Hongi, paintings of Hongi that were commissioned and done in England in the 1820s, it really does look like a realistic representation of the man himself. The decorations, well, obviously the Tai Moko is the decoration. That's the main sort of focus of the bust. But he does have ears, so he does have protruding ears on this bust, and he also has a top knot or a bun of hair tied up at the rear of his head, top rear of his head. Now that's different to the other two that I've seen. So for so long we thought that this particular bust was the only one in existence.
Now Brent, you've already mentioned how Hongi was a Maori chief. Could you tell us a bit more about who he actually was?
Now Hongi Hika is a really complex character. So Ngāpuhi war chief. And he wasn't necessarily going to be a war chief, but he was thrust into that position because all of his older brothers had been killed in previous battles. But what happened is he was tasked by his mother to seek Utua revenge for all of the past losses and the lives of the family members that had been lost in battles against other tribes. So he was tasked with that responsibility. And it stands to reason that with the interaction with the Europeans and the new technology available, that an astute and intelligent man such as Hongi would like to take advantage of these. So he travelled to Port Jackson or Sydney and Parramatta, hosted by the Reverend Samuel Marsden, and he was accompanied by Ruatara, who was one of his nephews, and a number of other chiefs. Now, while he was in Sydney and Parramatta, he was learning about European agriculture and looking at the legal system and infrastructure and new technologies of, that could benefit them. And so what they did is, when he was in Sydney, it's believed that he carved a wooden bust of his own likeness from a fence post from Samuel Marsden's Parramatta property. So that's the tonga that we're actually talking about today.
It's fascinating to understand more about that Sydney relationship, but given you're Sydney-based yourself, could you explain to our listeners a bit more about your personal relationship with Hongi and expand upon what you've already told us, please?
So my personal connection to Hongi Hika is twofold. Firstly, in that my four times great-grandmother Te Aoparo is the older sister to Te Hōtete, who was Hongi Hika's father. And then secondly, that Hongi Hika is intertwined in my three times great-grandfather's story. Moka te Kāinga Matā was a war chief, and I've been writing an historical novel, interactive historical novel, over the past 15 years, focusing on early New Zealand history through his eyes. And so being first cousins and then being involved in and living with each other over, you know, that 20 to 30 year period, they were supporting each other, they were involved in all of the campaigns together, they were virtually inseparable. So Moka had two other brothers, Rewa and Te Whararahi, and the three brothers and Hongi Hika, because Hongi Hika was basically left by himself after the death of his older brothers. And so they were a really tight unit and they did everything together.
If you could tell us a bit more about the short film that you're making too. It seems a remarkable way of recording and exploring Hongi's life.
Okay, so the short film really was an afterthought initially. So with my interactive historical novel, I was shooting sort of small reenactments of different things that had happened throughout the novel to make it more interactive for readers and especially children. And I started to realise that I had enough reenactments especially in relation to Hongi's role and his trip to England to make a short film all by itself, standalone short film. And so I decided to dedicate some time towards that, time and some funds. And, you know, I was fortunate that I was able to travel to England a few times. I must thank so many people and so many institutions that have supported us in kind, you know, letting us film on ground and in institutions without any filming fees at all. I mean, you've got to realise that, you know, without any funding, and that's pretty much what I've done at the moment, is, you know, being able to work on all of these projects with my own money. So, you know, I'd love some funding. I really would. If anyone out there is listening and you'd like to support our kaupapa, our projects, please feel free to contact us. But back to the film. So, You know, I really thank the actors involved, because most of them have gone above and beyond, and they've made themselves available. What I've found with creating a short film is it's not a lack of money. It's not approval to film at certain places. One of the real big issues you have, and one of the it's really problematic, is that you have to make sure that all the actors are available at the time that you want to film. And when you don't have a budget, you can't pay them the amount of money that they need to take time off work, that they can cross off days on their calendar and commit to a short film. So for me, that was a really big eye-opener, that, you know, it's really hard to get people at the same location at the same time without having a budget. But I'd love to say thank you so much to all of our actors and actresses. You know, like, they've done a fantastic job. And, you know, I haven't let anyone act for free. So, I mean, you know, even though I don't really have the funding, I've paid everyone out of my own savings, really. But in the Māori culture, we sort of have this thing called koha, where people, you know, offer to give you things or to help out and maybe act for free. And I understand that, and I appreciate that. But at the same time as well, they're giving up their time and possibly money if they're taking time off work, you know. So I always make sure that I can pay all of my actors and actresses. And there's one thing that I'm really proud of, that I really don't like to use people. So in all of the work that I do, you know, I want to make sure that everyone feels valued and for their time, their talents and their skills, and their company, you know, that you love their company while you're on set shooting. And there's been so many funny and enjoyable moments. You know, there's jokes, there's bloopers. You're always learning things. So you're learning things that you never knew from other people as well, even in relation to the research. Little stories that people have heard, that people have had passed down in their families that you haven't heard before. So, you know, the short film has been amazing. We've filmed, like I said, we filmed some scenes in New Zealand, you know, Australia, England, and we're just lucky that we've been able to put it together. So we're really proud of it. And, you know, when I say that, I mean, even when we look at the fact that we weren't funded, you know, and that's actually, I'll mention that, to just touch on it. I've been in a pretty unique situation. It's unfortunate in that, you know, I'm based in Australia, and so when I'm asking people for support, you know, or funding towards a project, the issue that I seem to run into is that the funding from New Zealand is difficult to obtain or acquire, because one, I'm an Australian citizen, and two, I'm an Australian resident. And so that basically rules me out of a lot of the funding criteria for sponsorships and grants and things like that in New Zealand. And then it's probably worse in Australia, where, you know, if I sort of apply for funding on this end, the issue is that people are saying, well, why would we fund a, you know, historical novel or a historical short film based on New Zealand's history? So as you can imagine, I'm sort of, it's almost like the analogy I'd use would be, I'm in a dinghy in the middle of the Tasman without any oars, and I'm just sort of drifting there. So, you know, my lifeline basically, my lifeline has been my own pay from my teaching gig. So, yeah, it's been very problematic. But in saying that, and this is what I want, you know, for all of my students, and this is, I think, one of the reasons why I've done it, is that, you know, I want my students and my own children to realise that if you want to do something, you don't have, there's no barriers, you just make it happen. So yes, it's challenging. Yes, it takes a long time and a lot of effort, and you're working so hard to do so many roles because you don't have the funding to pay anybody. But, you know, if you really are dedicated and passionate, you will make it happen. And I think that's what we've seen with this short film, that we're really passionate, and it did happen. And so for those of you who are attending our event, yeah, we hope you love it. And then we're taking it to New Zealand a couple of days later. We'll be showing it at Te Kōngahu Museum at the Waitangi Treaty Grounds. And then eventually what we're doing is we're looking at filming a couple more scenes, a few more scenes, and adding to that, extending it a little bit. And then we're going to koha or gift it, donate it to schools across New Zealand, because for those of you who may not be aware, the New Zealand government in late 2019 made the decision to make New Zealand history mandatory in New Zealand from 2022 onward. And so next year being 2022, this will be my koha or gift to all New Zealand students. to learn the most balanced and accurate and up-to-date history about these periods and these particular events and incidents. So, yeah, that's the short film.
I'm very inspired and excited by your passion and your drive, Brent. But and must say personally, really looking forward to seeing the short film as well. But in addition to the film, are there other ways that the Maori community, both in Australia and in New Zealand, are marking the bicentennial?
Okay, so some of the other ways that we are commemorating the bicentennial, apart from the short film, is we're holding a number of public events. Now, as we mentioned before, unfortunately we had to cancel the English-based events, but we still are having an event in Sydney. And then we're having some events in New Zealand. But what we're looking forward to is some educational initiatives. So that's the illustrated bilingual storybook, children's book. And we're also looking at holding a major exhibition in New Zealand in 2025. So we want to bring all of the taonga related to Hongi, Waikato and Thomas Kendall together in New Zealand to be exhibited together in a travelling exhibition. And so the idea behind that is that we'd start at Te Papa Tongarewa, which is the National Museum in Wellington, and we'd have those taonga or artefacts on show for about 4 months, and then they'd be packed up and transported to Tamaki Paengahira, which is the Auckland War Memorial Museum, and they'd be exhibited there also for about 4 months, and then finally they'd be transferred to Te Kongahu Museum, which is the Waitangi Treaty Grounds, and they'd be on display there for the final 4 months before those artefacts are returned to their places of residence, excepting hopefully for the kākahu, the cloak that Hongi gave the king. So it's my intention to work with museums across New Zealand and England to try and secure a long-term loan for that kākahu. So some of you may know that there was a Hawaiian cloak that was brought back to England by Captain Cook, and that has been loaned to the Bishop Museum in Hawaii for, I think, 99 to 100 years, so a long-term loan. So that's what we're hoping to do too. And the reason, the justification for that is that the British Museum didn't really know what the article was. They didn't know what the artifact was. They didn't know that it was Hongi's kākahu or that it, in fact, was gifted to the king. The fact that it's not on display, it's only in storage. And when I spoke with one of the curators, they were saying that less than 1% of all of the artifacts they have will ever be exhibited. Where in fact, if it was in New Zealand, it'd be on permanent display, not only for the New Zealand public, but also for descendants of Hongi. And for New Zealand students to have a look too. So, you know, as they're learning about Hongi Hika, Waikato and Thomas Kendall on their journey to England in 1820, they can view that taonga or that cultural treasure every day on display.
Now, you mentioned before that the bust in Sydney was not the only wooden carved bust of Hongi. Could you tell us the story about both it and the other bust?
So there are three carved busts purportedly of Hongi in existence. So one of them is in the Brighton Hove Museum in England. Another one is in the Auckland War Memorial Museum in New Zealand. And then another is this bust here at the Chalchakwinga Museum. Now, there's a lot of conjecture about exactly how many or which of the three carved busts Hongi carved himself while he was in Parramatta in 1814. So my research initially started, I wanted to try and identify the original. So I wanted to try and identify whether Hongi carved all three, or if he only carved one of them, which one was it? Was it the one in Brighton? Was it one in Auckland? Or was it the one here? And what I quickly learned is that it's not so much a matter of which is the original, it's the significance of all three of the busts. Okay, so that is more important in my eyes. What I'm looking at here is that I love the fact, absolutely love the fact, that there is one carved bust of Hongi in each of the three places that he travelled. So it maintains that connection between the three countries, that legacy of his journey and his experiences. So as I said, there's three carved busts, and I've had the pleasure and the honour of being able to hold those and examine each of the three. And I have some issues with the bust in Auckland, in that the kauai or the chin is squared off and it doesn't have any design there. And you'd think that, I mean, the symbolism of a tāmoko, you wouldn't go to all the effort of carving an entire upoko or head and then carve in all the tāmoko designs and then decide just to leave the kauai or the chin bare. That doesn't resonate well with me. I love the design though. Like I absolutely love the way that it looks, that style. It's a little bit abstract, but that was the first one that I ever saw. I think I saw that way back in about 2007, and it immediately struck me as being beautiful, and the significance of it being Hongihika wasn't lost either. And then I found out about the bust here when it was in the Maclay Museum. And I was looking at that, and if I was to say at that point in time, so I was only aware that there were two at that point in time. If I was to say that out of those two, out of the one in Auckland and the one in that here in Chao Chuk Wing, which one was the original or which one was the one that Hongi carved, I would definitely say that it was this one. Now, I went to England in January 2019, and for some reason I had this feeling. Now, we in New Zealand or in the Māori culture, we call it wairua, so like a spiritual feeling. And I really felt that there was something significant in England that I needed to see. And then, unfortunately, you know, I got back to Australia after the trip, and immediately I discovered and found out that there was supposedly another bust that may have been Hongihika, you know. And I was only disappointed in the fact that I didn't know about it that first time. And so a couple of months later, I organised to go back again. And when I viewed it, I was really impressed. So the workmanship is fantastic. The proportions are beautiful. And it looked like hardwood, looked like Australian hardwood as well. And so realistically, if we were to try and ascertain which one was the original between the bust that's in Brighton and the bust that we have here at the Chao Chuk Wing Museum, it's proving difficult. And I think, you know, dendrology, so if we test the wood, if we take a slither of wood from the base of each of the busts, that might assist us in trying to find out, you know, which one it could be. Because obviously the description we have is that it was carved from a fence post on Marsden's property. Now, the fence post in Parramatta would most likely be some kind of a eucalypt or gum. And so, you know, that would go a long way into deducing which one would be the one that Hongi carved. They're both absolutely beautiful. The designs are striking, they're clean, and they do realistically look like, you know, a human head. And the workmanship is very, very different. So the workmanship on the bust in Brighton and the bust here at Chao Chuk Wing are, in my opinion, far, far more superior to the design and the carving on the bust in Auckland.
It's really quite extraordinary. And we have this, you know, remarkable story of the three different busts. Do you know anything about the one that's here in Sydney and how it actually ended up in our museum? Is there any record as to how it's ended up within this collection?
Okay, so the history of the bust here in Chao Chuk Wing is somewhat convoluted in that the earliest that we can trace it back is that it was in the collection of the Nicholson Museum in the mid to late 1800s. So there's no paperwork, no accompanying paperwork to suggest any provenance for that. But it is the oldest known bust, the oldest recorded bust of Hongi being in any institution at all. So the other two, the bust that's in Brighton that was found by a lady called Lillian Bately from Portslade. And I was wondering, how did it get from Lillian Bately in Portslade to the Brighton Museum? What was the connection? Now, when I did a quick Google search, looked on Google Maps, and apparently Portslade is like a town right next to Brighton. So the Brighton Museum was the biggest major museum to this woman. And so, you know, it stands to reason that she decided to donate it to the Brighton Museum. Now, she doesn't have any paperwork or anything to suggest any provenance. She doesn't know how it came to be in her family. And so the Brighton bust is almost You know, although that was, I think it was 1957, Lillian Bailey donated that. So before that, there's no provenance for it. But I have an inkling that that was the one that was sent by Samuel Marsden to the Church Missionary Society in London, that was in a Church Missionary Society journal printed in 1816. Anyway, so we go to the Auckland bust, and the Auckland bust was found in a house in Wales in 1967. And so that was the last one to be found or located. And so realistically, when we look at this, so in terms of busts and have they been in institutions and have they been acknowledged, so this bust that we have at the Chalchuk Wing has been in a museum for longer than the other two. So as I said, the late 1890s, late 1800s. And then the next one was the one at the Brighton Museum, and we're looking at, I think it was 1957, and then we're looking at the one in Auckland, and I think that's come to the fore in 1967. Okay, so that's the timeline. Unfortunately, we don't have any provenance, you know, for many of those.
Brent, what does the bust mean to you personally? What do you find when you look at it each time?
I think what I'm impressed by and what resonates with me is that there's three of them, and there's one in each of the three countries to which he travelled. So it maintains that connection between the three countries, and it maintains his legacy of where he travelled and what he did.
And what do you find each time you actually look at the bust and you spend time with the bust here in Sydney?
Well, it's a little bit different for me. It's not simply an artifact, or even a taonga, a cultural treasure. We look at items like this as being imbued with the character and the personality of the subject. And so I don't look at the bust as a carved bust. I look at the bust as in hongi. I look at that and I speak to him I share the space with hongi. And I wonder what kind of experiences he had. And I wonder what would he think of the world today. So if he was here today, what would he think of the world? What opportunities would he take? What decisions would he make?
So what can we learn from Hongi Hicker's story, Brent? What other takeaway lessons do you believe?
So Hongi Hicker's story is someone who was left without a number of siblings and family members as a result of war, someone who had been tasked with seeking revenge for the losses of those lives. And you can imagine that weighing on you, you're responsible, you know, to make sure that you square the ledger. And so as we've mentioned earlier, with the new technologies available with muskets and firearms, so Hongi decided that would be the best strategy, you know, to gain more firearms. And he travelled, as we said, he travelled to Sydney in 1814. And that would have been sort of, you know, trying to find out more about technology and learning about military strategies and tactics. But then again in 1820, so he and Waikato was his brother-in-law, and the CMS missionary Thomas Kendall travelled to England. And when they were in England, they helped comprise an English Māori dictionary called A Grammar and Vocabulary of the Language of New Zealand, which was being worked on by Professor Samuel Lee, a linguist at Queen's College and Cambridge University. Now, Thomas Kendall, having written an English Māori dictionary, A Korao no New Zealand, which was published in Sydney in 1815, wanted to contribute towards that. He thought that if he didn't have any role in that book written by an academic, that his work would be relegated to obscurity. And so he really wanted to make sure that he had an input and a contribution to that book. So that was one of his goals. He also wanted to be ordained as a priest. Now, he normally wouldn't be because he was a layman missionary. And so there's requirements to becoming priests, such as, you know, understanding Latin and being able to read and write in ancient Greek and other requirements. So and also that he was at odds with some of the other missionaries in New Zealand, and Samuel Marsden wasn't very happy with him. And so Thomas Kendall being ordained as a priest probably would never have happened if he didn't travel to England and help so substantially with the compilation of this new Māori English dictionary. Now, also, Hongi and Waikato were absolutely feted by high society in England. They were taken to fairs and soirees and dinner parties. And they were hosted by Sir John Mortlock, a banker, and Sir Lady Pym. They were introduced to the peerage at the House of Lords on the 21st of October. And then they were also given an audience with the King, King George IV, at Carlton House on the 13th of November. They exchanged gifts, so Hongi and Waikato taking off their kākahu or woven flax cloaks and placing them at the feet of the king. And in exchange, the king gave them a number of items. I'm going to say a number of items, some items of real value. So we're looking at double-barreled flintlock fowling guns, which are sporting guns. And they had a ceremonial plaque attached saying that they were gifted by King George IV to Shung Hee, King of Ngāpuhi of New Zealand, and likewise for Waikato, Prince Waikato of Rangihu. They were given a gilded metal lifeguard's helmet with bearskin crest. They were given a scabbard and a military straight sword. They were given a shako, which is a military hat, a leather stock as part of the uniform. They were given a red scarlet coat with blue facing and silver silver lacing. And they were also given chainmail suit of armour. So, you know, the exchange wasn't so bad. I'm pretty sure that Hongi and Waikato were quite happy with that meeting and that trade. And so what happened is they were given a tour of Carlton House, the gardens, the armoury that was upstairs, and that's where they were given these gifts. And they were also given a tour of the Tower of London and then also the Royal Arsenal, which is out at Woolwich. And so they really were feted and looked after quite well while they were in England. And so this leads us to why 2021 is important for us. Now, obviously, we're looking at the tour that went to England. The men went to England in 1820, and so the bicentennial would have been last year, being 2020. Now, unfortunately, COVID, we had some events lined up, and our opening event was going to be at Queen's College and Cambridge University last year, but because of COVID, we had to cancel all of our English-based events. So 2021 is the year that we get back on track.
It truly is a remarkable story, Brent, and I'm so, so pleased that you've been able to get the commemoration, the bicentennial commemoration, back on track. What now for you? What's next after this?
I'm also just nearing completion of a research paper or a journal article focusing on the meeting between Hongi and the King. The exchange of gifts between them, which is known as tuku, so reciprocal gifting. I'm also providing an in-depth description of all of the gifts that were exchanged between the two leaders, something that has never happened before. And obviously because I've come across these documents that people haven't had access to, so that's really fortunate for me at this time. Also, the second half of the research paper focuses on, it's a study, an in-depth study of the kākahu or the woven harakeke flex cloak that Hongi gifted King George IV, and this is in the British Museum. So they weren't really aware that they had it or the significance of that particular cloak. To them, it's just been a Māori cloak. But all of our research leads to the fact that it points to the fact that this is in fact the kākahu that Hongi gave to King George IV on the 13th of November 1820.
What an amazing story, Brent, and what a remarkable journey Hongi had. And we are so, so fortunate in the Chow Chak Wing Museum to have within the collection an item associated with it. And so fortunate to have such passionate people such as yourself able to share your knowledge and your stories. Thank you so much for joining us today, Brent Karahona, taking us on a journey through the story of Hongi Hika. Object Matters is recorded on the grounds of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation. The Chow Chak Wing Museum and the University of Sydney pay our respect to the traditional owners, and we acknowledge elders past, present, and emerging.
Subscribe to Object Matters on your favourite podcast app and connect with the Chow Chak Wing Museum on Instagram, Twitter, and Facebook. You can also subscribe to our monthly e-newsletter, News Extra, via our website, sydney.edu.au/museum.